Hey everybody, how we going? My name is Kate and you're listening to This Australian Life. We will always be in this slot, maybe not for the rest of my life, but you know, for the foreseeable future. This Australian Life is, I like to think of it as LGBTIQ plus stories. Just we interview generally one person and ask them a bunch of questions about their life. This week we are talking with Kristen. She's amazing. Really, she's had such a varied life. And I always find it really interesting when people have an amazing story, but they're super humble. Anyway, let's just get into it.
So we'll get to that. We'll get to the magazine for sure. So just just hearing your music taste, like, you must know that's so varied, with so many different genres of music all in one place. Like, has anyone ever said that to you? Like, you know, just pick one.
Oh, no, that would never suggest pick one. Well, it would be really hard to just pick one. See, everything has a story. I first heard that album, I think that was made in 1976. And I was producing The Big Issue, the very first incarnation of The Big Issue in London. I was the production editor on that. And my colleague, who actually knew more about producing, was sitting across the screens from me. And he would sit up all night doing the desktop design, and he would play that album. And I've never heard anything like it.
Obviously, like, you care so much about music. Is that something that you started to realize from a young age?
I do. I've realized that rhythm and story are really important for me. And I realized my first gig, I had two gigs in my first gig story. The first gig I had a ticket for, I was 13, and I was going to see Motorhead at the Crawley Leisure Centre in South East England. And I got dropped off outside the venue, and it was full of motorbike patched people, and I just thought, I can't do this. This is on my own. I can't do this. I can't go into
what
that venue.
What did you look like? Did you look like a bit of a dweeb or something compared to these guys?
I just looked like a 13-year-old kid with really bad spots, you know. I just looked like I was coming to see if Mum or Dad had the money for the dinner whilst they were having a good time at the gig. It was just... So I didn't go, even though I had a ticket. This was the Overkill tour as well, I think. This is how far back we're talking.
Which I think is funny, this detail that Kristen thinks that I am going to know how far back that is.
So the next week, I went to see Black Sabbath because, you know, they're much more toned down compared to Motorhead. So my first gig was Black Sabbath at the Crawley Leisure Centre. But shortly after that, I went to see Tangerine Dream play at Fairfield Halls. And, I remember they played what became the Logos album in 1982, I think. And I stood, I was in the bathroom at half time. They had a break at half time, and I couldn't stand up. The reverberations had gone through me so much, and I thought, this is extraordinary. The week, so previously I'd gone to see Sabbath, and I'd put my head in the speaker bin at the front, and I couldn't hear for several, well, probably a week. And then I'd been to see Tangerine Dream, I couldn't stand up. And I thought, how does music affect you so much in so many different ways? And I think I've been exploring that question ever since.
Isn't that so interesting, the way that different music, different venues can affect us in different ways? Like, I remember my first concert was NSYNC in a giant stadium. And I remember I just left thinking, wow, I will never, ever do that again.
And I used to love recording radio stations on Radio London, I think. And I used to make sort of favourite cassettes of all of his various students. And I got to interview him a few times, and I got to talk to him. My favourite Giles Peterson anecdote is asking him at the Bridge in Brixton to play Grant Green's Make It Funky and seeing the expression on his face as he realised what an awesome tune that was and how cool it would be to play it in the middle of the nightclub in Brixton.
I start getting this feeling, and maybe you're getting it too, that Kristen is just, she speaks a different language, a language of music that I do not understand.
Do you feel like you meet other people like you who have this love for music and you sort of have this like instant connection with them?
Yeah. Yeah. I find if I go to a coffee shop, there's a coffee shop down the road where I've actually just been, and the guys in there, they all seem to love music. And I just start, you know, I say, this is Frida Kuti, isn't it? And they'll say, yeah. And I'll say, oh, their drummer just passed away. This is a few weeks ago. And they'll say, oh, no, and we'll start talking. And then we'll end up, at some point, we'll end up getting me saying something like, oh, I interviewed Grandma for Flash in New York. And just seeing that kind of joy and surprise and then shared love of another story and of another memory of, oh, yeah, White Lines, let's go and play that, you know. And so you have a story or you have a memory which leads to another thought about another piece of music, which leads to another set of stories, and it's all collectively. I think music can do extraordinary things. I use it to write. I use it to allow me to enjoy journeys. We were at a dinner party recently in a lockdown allowed situation, and a Human League track from Dare came on, and I knew the track, but I hadn't heard it for so long, and I just found myself nodding, and the person whose house we were in said, yeah, this is amazing, isn't it? And I was like, yeah, I've known this for 25 years.
You're not one of those people where it's like, and this is sort of a weird question, but where like you hear a song and like you know exactly where you heard it before. Like, could you remember that song like 25 years ago when you'd heard it last?
So I'll just say for all of you, you know, future interviewers out there, maybe you do it already, like, this is a weird question outside of the context of the interview. Like, I wouldn't ask my mom that because I know she does not know the last time she heard most songs. But for me, it just illustrates another really important reason why I don't write down questions.
Like, could you remember that song like 25 years ago when you'd heard it last?
I think, yes, I can remember. So it may not be the first time I heard it, but I always... So when I saw Out of Time, I remember being in a record store in Bedford in West Yorkshire and thinking this was an exceptional song. As I saw the front cover of Out of Time last week, I was taken back to 1991, staying in a record store in Yorkshire. I remember a Massive Attack single piece of music. The same thing. I was in France. I was working as a journalist doing a piece about English football in the World Cup in 1998, and I had been given a 4x4 to drive around the country for 6 weeks to do this. It was a great gig. It was a brilliant job, and I took mezzanine with me, and I remember sticking it into the CD player on that first sort of just arriving on the other side of the border, and I'm driving around northern France, and mezzanine starts, and it was just that slow build-up of the opening track, and I just thought, wow. And every time I hear that now, I'm reminded of that drive and of an Adidas ad with David Beckham.
So isn't that amazing? Like, I would have never known that Kristen had this amazing photographic memory. It's just such a cool thing to learn about. And I guess the most interesting thing we've learned so far about Kristen, in my opinion, is that she has a photographic memory. That's pretty cool.
Because they use the soundtrack for that. But music, I have a photographic memory, which has been helpful for things like my revised two hard exams and just remembering, you know, I'd write down long kind of code. There's a word for it, and it just escaped my brain for what it's called. But you can write down like a whole kind of dot point list of important sayings or facts or phrases, trigger words, whatever, and create a long kind of 9-letter bracketing thing of it, and I can see it on a piece of paper, and I go into an exam and I just write down that code, and I have 9 different sort of dot points that are like basically 2.5 essays worth of material, and it's really, really helpful. But I didn't realize for a long time that that's what I could do in things like exams. And now as a playwright, when I'm doing, when I'm creating plays, I see the stage, I see the place, because it's not ready to do a stage for quite a while now. I see the space, and I see what I want to have happen in that space, often with a musical background to it. And then I start to inform that space with what's happening.
That's amazing. I'm so jealous of you that you have that ability. I guess, you know, we're talking about mostly positive experiences, right, with music and stuff. But do you find that, say, with negative experiences, like, that you end up reliving those things a bit more maybe than other people because you can remember things so clearly?
I don't think I'd ever really thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. I mean, I've done a lot of therapy work, self-care on trauma, and I don't think I've experienced any particular kind of worse, childhood trauma than the next person that knows what childhood trauma is like. But I seem to have held onto it, and not in a maudlin way, but I've held on to it in a way that is both useful and harmful. Yeah, perhaps the depth of its impact is more sustained, simply because I can, because it's stored somewhere deeper. But as a child, we're trying to normalize this experience. We're also trying to make it go away. And I think I would use that phrase quite literally, make it go away. I can remember my head under a pillow and saying that as one of my parents would have picked the pillow up and said, it's okay. But I just spent what felt like 20 minutes saying, make it go away, make it go away, make it go away. And we find that we are reliving that experience.
I'm just going to rephrase this with I instead of we. So I find that I am reliving that experience.
But also that practice of how you deal with things that are difficult. If a fellow grown-up says, you just need to pull yourself together and crack on, I'm still using the childlike processing skills that began and ended with make it go away. That can be quite horrific, yeah. So it has a good side and a bad side.
So you talked about that idea of like crack on. Was that something that was said to you as a kid?
Oh, we had so my dad's Irish Catholic. My mum was probably a working class background from her family in South London. And they were both children of, well, they were born in the 40s. So I was brought up in the late 60s, early 70s, and my parenting experience from them was that I was encouraged to ask questions, so that was good. My mum said that meant that I could start trying to stick my fingers in the sockets as a baby. I was left outside the library. Can you imagine this in the modern day? I was left outside the library in South London in the pram, because I'd caused so much chaos. I tried to pull all the books off the shelves, and so Mum just left me outside in the pram while she carried on in the library. I mean, they come from a world where my gran refused to leave London during the war because she hated it being anywhere other than in a city. And they came back from the cinema one night during the Blitz, and the house had been blown up. And so they just moved to another house.
I love this because it really just helps me put things in perspective about my life.
You know, Gran was very practical, but emotionally very stunted, I think. The lessons, and my grandfather, my dad's dad died. He was an alcoholic, and he died in his 40s in a gas explosion. The reason he died was because he was passed out and he was in the building, and when everyone was told to leave, they didn't pick him up because they couldn't see him because he was under his desk and he went up with the building. So they came from a world where you did literally pull yourself together and you crack on and you do things. But that does mean that if you were a child at, say, 9 and you didn't understand math questions and your father was trying to explain to you how you deal with this and you just don't understand, then he'd beat you over the head. So I got whacked continuously over the head.
I wish there could be something in our lives that would not whack us over the head, but constantly remind us to do the exact opposite of what was told to Kristen. This idea of slow down and feel what's going on instead of crack on.
Well, somebody who didn't have the emotional range to deal with a child that just didn't understand. I mean, it's abuse, and it is abuse, and it's an abusive world to be in. And I think it's important that we call it for what it is. So for me, what I've had to do is I've had to learn to acknowledge that they didn't have any other choice, really. They had no other way of behaving and parenting. And my way of making that right is to ensure that I don't pass that on to our child that we have.
I take this moment to take a short break to reintroduce our guest. Also, you're on Joy 94.9. In case you didn't know, and you're listening to This Australian Life. It's LGBTIQ+ stories where we learn everything about somebody's life. So we're talking with Kristen. She's had an amazing career in terms of she's worked for a number of magazines, but I think most importantly is her story of resilience that we're learning about right now.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it's I think we take for granted, you know, it's not like your parents could just turn on a meditation podcast and, you know, learn how to be better. Like there wasn't any,
mindfulness types.
Yeah. was there ever a time like, you know, with your parents where you did notice a crack in kind of this armor with them?
I've had times, you know, my mum and I have not always had the most cordial. She does not agree with my transgender, and she finds my transitioning very difficult to process and understand. But she has asked me, you know, before this and possibly since, often she'll say, sometimes I just don't understand, and sometimes I just don't know whether I made any of the right choices. My father had a real, I mean, he comes from an Irish Catholic lineage of hard workers, loud voices, and hard drinkers. And he struggled for a long time. He was incredibly successful, really bright. He was an actuary, mathematician, beautiful, beautiful man. I loved him. I loved him with all my heart. And one of the great gifts for me was to be able to help him with his struggles with his drinking. And the last few years of his life, he had Korsakoff, so he had, you know, he had some serious brain damage that led to Alzheimer's and dementia and ultimately Parkinson's. And, you know, and I was able to just do things like go for walks with him and help him and talk to him a bit about his experience with his dad. And we put our relationship back together again. He was a really, really beautiful man, but when he was angry, he would intimidate the planet. He could be so, there was something, there was a rage and a fury inside him that just was awful to be in the same room and space as.
I think this is an amazing thing to hear about for two reasons. One, to again just remind those listening that Kristen has a photographic memory, so she could very well remember this anger like it happened yesterday, I assume, over and over again. And also, what does that do to a person to know that that type of anger exists in the world and how it changes how you might interact with others?
The very last time I saw him, I was feeding him like a child. I was feeding him on a little spoon, putting the food into his mouth. Here comes the train, you know. Suddenly, and this happens a lot with people with dementia, he just stood up, he flung the spoon out of my hand, and he stood up and he said, "Don't you dare do that. I know what you're doing." And for the first time in my life, I wasn't scared. And I was sat in my seat and I looked up at him and I said, "It's okay, Dad. It's okay. I love you." And he just sat back down and started staring back straight ahead as if it hadn't happened. And I just gently cried and I held his hand and I just said, "I love you."
Thank you. That story is wonderful. Switching gears a little bit, how did you get started at the magazine? Like, what's that about?
Well, I always wanted to be a say I always wanted to. And I always wanted to be a writer, but I forgot that for a long time, and I thought I wanted to be a journalist. Whilst I was a teenager and wanting to be a journalist, writing all the time, writing plays, writing lyrics, writing... I produced a magazine at home when I was 13, named it after the street and the number of our house, and it had a whole bunch of little news items, including my favourite music of that week. And I found it later on. It was amazing, and I found that when I was in my 20s. So I got I went to university, and I became editor of the student magazine. A friend of mine was over in Manchester and London, in England. And I'd go over there and work with him a bit on some of the Mancunian pieces that they were doing. And somehow I ended up interviewing Madtronics at the Hacienda for a piece for our Bradford police magazine. And that was my first piece of credited journalism at 18.
I was going to say, is there something about you that you think makes you a really good journalist?
Oh, I don't know if I'm a really good journalist, but I love talking to people. I love finding out what's going on for them underneath. Mm. And I think that's interesting for them as well, because certainly, I've done a lot of different types of interviews with a lot of sports people, a lot of Gordon Ramsay, and from all sorts of walks of life, Eddie Izzard, and you know what I found is that they will have a standard response to questions because they do this a lot. But what I've always tried to do is get a bit like what you're being able to do here, actually, is to explore something different. Mm. And that's really interesting for them, I think. A genuine interest in what was happening to somebody when they started doing something, or when they made a decision, or when things changed, is always interesting, because it helps the person who's been asked the question to reflect a little in a way that they perhaps wouldn't do if they just did this on their own. So it becomes a mutual process, which is a brilliant interview when both of you are actually engaged in the answer and in the exploration itself. I worked for The Big Issue. A great guy from the BBC came in. And
so The Big Issue, for those who don't know, it's a street newspaper. It was founded by John Bird and Gordon Roddick in September 1991, and it's published on four continents. The idea of how it works is it's for offering homeless people like the ability to have a job, and you know, they hand out the newspaper on the street.
I worked for The Big Issue. It's a great guy from the BBC came in and talked to us a bit about what life was going to be like, and he said, you know, he's a war journalist. He's been in the Balkans War. He's just come back. And he said, as journalists, you're experts in something for a day. And your job is to constantly change and find out what you can be interested in and become an expert in next. That's been really helpful for me as my life has pivoted from one thing to another, literally now from one gender to another. And I've had to become an expert in something, not just for a day, but I love that fluidity and that flexibility. And I think fluidity and flexibility is one of the great gifts of human beings.
I love that too. And I reckon it also marks what a good journalist is. It's somebody who's able to have a fluid mind, who's able to hold off judging things and to let themselves go with the flow.
We should all explore that more than we do. We get locked into the notion of who we are and what we can and should be. And I suppose that was created out of a sense of order and the need for rules. But it also, you know, there's a patriarchal component to that keeps us small, keeps us in our place. And I've never been small, and I've never been in my place.
Yeah, you don't seem small. That's such a good way to describe anything.
I find it so extraordinary now, as a trans female, when friends and new friends message me and they say, I see you. You know, that phrase that we use now, we use that in civil rights, we see you, I see you. But I think it means a little lot to the person that's doing the seeing, because it allows them to realise the impact that they have by affirming the place of others.
When you talk about the ability as a journalist to switch to understand something in a day, and this idea of exploration, of talking to people and figuring things out together, how does that work as a playwright when you just have your own head to deal with?
That's a lovely question. It's been really interesting. I studied at the VCA last year, Victoria here, and I learned a lot of this stuff. I had as an intuition, and I didn't know if it was right or wrong. And what I love about the master's program I did last year was that I was assured that what I had previously thought of innately was actually helpful, really helpful insight and really useful. And what I found now is I wrote a play last year, three plays last year, and one was the big piece that was a sort of a history of our three generations of our family. So there I became I like to think in terms of flaneuring, the idea of a leaf blowing, falling from the tree and then blowing, and then being taken by the wind and blowing its way through, in this case, history. And so starting with my gran, and then going through my mum's, and then my aunt's experience, and then my own experience, and then kind of weaving all of that together. And some of it was factual, some of it became completely fictionalized. But I was now the leaf that was moving through all of this world.
I love this. I think this is such a beautiful metaphor. At first, while Kristen was talking about the idea of moving through a conversation, the insights that come from that, this idea that she's moving through her own mind like a leaf, just seeing what flows out.
And so I started with something that was real, and then it took me to somewhere that was imagined. And I think, like all of us, you know, we go through our day and we have a bunch of interactions. Even on our own, we will have interactions, because we'll have interactions with sounds, with our thoughts, with the kettle that does or doesn't work, you know, the dog that barks, all of those things. And if we're outside, we have even more interactions. And if we switch on a computer, we have a global interaction at our fingertips. And at some point, those interactions sit with us. And as a playwright, I realized that I respond to all of that.
So just to reiterate what Kristen just said, because I think it's really quite important, is that in her life, a lot of different things happen. She's interacting all the time with people. And as a playwright, this is her moment to give her take on those things that have happened.
And then what's become beautiful and, if you like, simple, is that my first job as a writer now is to create a world, to imagine a space, and then that space, things start to happen in it. But as an audience, when you first come into wherever we are going to be now in the future of theatre, you come into a space, and you have to have a sense that this space has some form of authenticity or agency to it. It's not chaotic in the sense that it doesn't make any sense. Because I think when we go to certain spaces, if you go into a store or even a cafe and it's chaotic, you usually feel that you really don't want to be there.
I think this is really cool too, just like an interesting insight into theater, say. Like, I don't know if you guys are familiar with any of the more absurdist plays. I'm not, but one I do remember when I was reading in high school was this one by Eugene Ionesco. It's called The Bald Soprano, and it kind of makes fun of, apparently the inspiration was off of learning the English language. So you have characters who are like, "Hi, Bob, how are you?" And all the characters are named Bob. It's like, "I'm fine. How are you, Bob? Like, how old are you, Bob?" It's been a while since I read it. But anyway, the point I'm trying to get at is that the play itself is incredibly simple. Like, everything about it has been pared down so you can understand something that's quite absurd. Just in our own art, you know, if you're an artist, I think it's interesting to think about.
But if you go to a cafe that is just humming and is working, and these cafes can all be completely different. They can be completely different worlds, but there's something about them that just feels right. Then you're willing to sit there and experience what happens next. And as a playwright, your job is to get people feeling, okay, I trust this space. And then you can start messing with them.
So do you, as an artist, do you have anxiety? Like, do you wonder, like, do you question 100 times what you're writing? Do you never know if it's done? Like, how has that process been for you?
My first anxiety, and there are many, my first anxiety is, will I be able to do this again? You know, after finishing the VCA last year, I then went through December and January here in Victoria thinking, I know I should rest, but I'm beginning to think that maybe as each day and then week slips away, but the longer I leave this, the less likely it is that I'll be able to hold on to what I do. So there was some uncertainty there. And then I experienced what I think every single writer or artist will always experience, which is that moment when you make a decision to begin something. And you stare at the screen, or you stare at the paper, or you stare at the coffee that you're drinking instead of doing the actual thing that you said you would do for the next hour. And you think, I've got nothing to say. I've got nothing to say. I had no idea what I've got to say. And then somehow you begin to find something to say. And I will say at this point, I always use music as a starting point. I find that music takes me and evokes a mood and an idea. Something will come up. So I start writing.
I will say, just from my own perspective, as a journalist, as whatever I am doing this show, it doesn't feel quite like journalism, is that I think this is so brave of Kristen. I always have something to work from. She is working from nothing.
And then, as you say, I then look at it and I think, is this any good? Is this any good? Which I think every artist on this planet will have that experience every single time. Is this any good? And I love that idea that our fabulous teacher, Raimonda Cortez, has said, at the VCA, says, my job is no longer to decide if this is any good. My job is just to put it down. Noel Gallagher talks about catching tunes as they fall from the heavens. And he may have said skies, but I like to think he should have said heavens. I like to think it's a spiritual process.
I like that too. And when I think of it as a spiritual process, then I know that it's really out of my control.
Songs come down and he catches them and he recognizes he doesn't catch all of them. And Raimondo says, our job is just to write it down. Sybil Kempson's a beautiful teacher and writer who came over from Brooklyn last year, from New York. She studied at Brooklyn College, but she lives in New York. And she said that she didn't want to hear the words would, should, or could for the next few weeks as we went into a deep, immersive space with her. And she taught us to use the other side of our brains. But just as a child, we would just do stuff. We watch children now, and they just say things. They do that. You go to a cafe and watch and listen to a child. They just say stuff. They don't question whether this is the right time to say it. They don't question whether this is something that might hurt your feelings. They have a thought. They say it. And as writers, we've lost that ability to have a thought and write it down.
And also, I'll just, before our break, end on this note, is that kids, they never apologize for what they say. And I think as a journalist, as someone who's doing what I do, I have to get used to that as well. Hey, everybody. My name is Kate, and you're listening to This Australian Life on Joy 94.9. This Australian Life, I'm sorry if you've been listening from the beginning and you're going, I don't want to hear it anymore. But we talk to one person about their life story. I ask some questions, and hopefully we learn a little bit more about ourselves. Right now, we're talking with Kristen, and she's been telling us all about what it's like to be both a journalist and a playwright. And if you can't tell by now, Kristen's really gone through the I don't know, the wheel work of careers, and this is actually just the beginning.
Switching back to you working at the magazine, helping start it, were your parents really proud of you?
They were really proud, depending on which magazine it was. When I worked in the big issue, they were super proud because that was wonderful. That was helping the homeless help themselves. That was a fabulous social justice. You know, John Bird, who started that magazine, is now Lord Bird. Lord Bird of Notting Hill. He's in the House of Lords. Brings a measure of streetwise, kind of authenticity to proceedings. I'm sure I catch up with him once every 10 years. I bump into him somewhere in London and we have a cup of coffee. And he says, I remember the day you sat around the table and you looked me in the eye and you assured me that you knew what you were doing. And I knew even then that you were lying. But I love the fact that you had the bottle to say that you said you knew what you were doing. And he was right. I was absolutely winging it at the time. I had no idea how to use computers for desktop. We used in Clark Express, and I had no idea. I'd never used it, but I was absolutely determined to figure out how to use it and keep this job and make it happen. And he was, 20 years later, he's looking me in the eye at the coffee and said, I knew you were lying. I went from that to Loaded, and we did 2 years of it was like being in a rock and roll band on the guest list of Blur and Oasis for every single party.
And just for those of you who don't know, I know I didn't. Loaded is a men's magazine. The tagline for it is for men who should know better. So I reckon you get the idea about that. It's got semi-clothed women, but right now it doesn't because it sort of rebranded itself. Anyway, it started in 1994, and in 2015 it went to a new digital version.
London in the 94-95, and it was an extremely hedonistic time and wild adventures all over the world.
And you know, I think it's really interesting that we actually, not to burst your bubble, don't ever go on to talk about those wild hedonistic adventures. Like, maybe it's a flaw in me as a journalist, but I just think that the adventures, the heart of the mind of our past traumas, like, those are the things that are really quite exciting.
Carried on in that kind of vein for a few years. I ended up writing a book about the World Cup in France, the English football team, and I just ran out of steam. So I decided that what I needed to do was I needed to go and do something good for change. So I went to an aid agency, an international aid agency, and I persuaded them that I could do the job of a fundraising innovator. I think I remember telling them in the interview that magazines were basically gangs, lots of gangs. Everybody's in a gang, and you identify your creds by which magazine or which book you read or which band you like or what sort of fashion tribe you feel you're a part of, and which football team you support, and all of those tribal kind of things that are very, very English in particular. It's extremely, extremely British kind of culture of gang kind of tribalism. Somehow that conveyed itself to the idea that people who support certain charities felt that they, these, 40 or 50-year-old people in the suburbs and the home counties of England, that they too are in a gang. That our job was to persuade them that their gang had this incredible reach and this incredible scalable importance. And so somehow I ended up working for an aid agency that saw me in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and Uganda and Ethiopia. And I'm taking...
And, I talked in the beginning of this interview about how Kristen is humble. I would say that's pretty obvious from everything else she said, but especially in this moment, it pops out to me when she says, somehow she got this job, like I would hire her in a second.
People have given us, a lot of money, and I'm taking them around these places, and I'm getting them to give us even more money, and I'm learning about photojournalism as I'm now traveling with these groups, because you try and save as much money as you can on staff costs as a well-run international aid agency. And at some point in all of that, I think I decided that I really wanted to be a photojournalist. So I then went and did a master's in photojournalism and became a photojournalist. And I was in some of these countries now doing documentary work for hospitals because a lot of the health interactions are going on overseas. And I somehow ended up working for the King's Fund, which is, I now understand, one of the most extraordinary health think tanks in the world and has this amazing reputation. I'd never heard of it because I had come from tribal culture, pop culture, sports and music and fashion.
And this reminds me, if you've been listening since the beginning, one of the first things that I asked Kristen was, she was telling me all about the CDs that she'd bought, and each one was a different genre. And I said, well, has anybody else just said, like, just choose one? And it's clear that there's not much about Kristen that just wants to choose one.
Magazines. At this point, I'd already done a radio show on Radio 1 for 6 months. Doing fashion updates on Thursday night, which meant that I ended up in New York interviewing Grandmaster Flash for the last show of the year. we kept some budgets, so we just all got on a plane and went to New York. You know, I went from that kind of world to a really serious health think tank with health economists and policymakers who are working for Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and making huge calls on masses and masses of millions of pounds worth of investment. And, you know, as life often takes you on these strange pathways, 2 years later, I'm sitting in an Australian parliament as a health policy advisor for Bob Brown, leader of the Greens.
What?
And I'm sitting there, you know, making
policy. You can't make
policy.
This up. Like, it's too crazy to write down. Like, people would be like, it's inconceivable. Like, I don't buy it.
Exactly. It is literally like a life. You know, so there I am. I messaged my old editor from the Loaded days, who I'm still friends with. So, you know, going from that world to sitting here with Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard and then Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull and even Scott Morrison, you know, and making, often sitting there making and being part of a process where mental health funding decisions are being made. You know, $500 million investment in youth mental health or a $25 million investment in education programs for people with psychosis. All these things. And I would spend my whole time bumbling around Parliament House in Canberra with this kind of thing in my head that says, I'm really just passing through and I have no idea what I'm doing.
Again, that humbleness is astounding to me and just so special. But also, I just want to say, like, I think what makes Kristen perfectly apt at being this type of chameleon that can go from one job to another, and it sounds like excel at all of them, is this idea that, one, she's incredibly interested in other people. Two, I reckon a photographic memory makes you a very valuable person in anything, and especially policy.
And then because of being a journalist, people talk to you. And people will really give you loads and loads of information about what's going on. And what I love about being a policy advisor is that when people are doing a speech or they're making a funding decision or whatever, they can only retain three things. That's all they've got time for. So you just have to consolidate everything down to two or three simple things and then tell a story behind them that makes sense and that gives them the position and changes the room, changes the mood, and makes a big difference to somebody at the other end of it.
And just on this point, I think it's funny that, you know, Kristen has probably had to teach herself this because she probably does hold way more information than 3 points, but she's had to figure it out. And also, I will just say she does it just there. She gives us 3 points.
And it gives them the position and changes the room, changes the mood, and makes a big difference to somebody at the other end of it. And that's really as simple as it needs to be. And then you just don't get scared about the fact you're talking about millions and millions of dollars. Because at the end of the day, you're just talking about a decision. Do I think this is a good idea or do I not think this is a good idea? So I've gone from being a journalist or a production editor at Big Issue and Loaded magazine and then radio shows with Grandmaster Flash and, you know, interviewing Joel Peterson and goodness knows how many other people. And then taking pictures in Tajikistan and looking at all these grey planes that arrived in Bishkek in Kyrgyzstan and realizing that the reason they're grey is that they're US bombers and that they're there because they're still fighting these wars and all, you know, and it's just all of that stuff. And then in Parliament House in Australia, with, I mean, a very swift turnaround of prime ministers, such is the way of Australian politics. And, you know, and that's been quite a life, but that is nothing compared to the moment when you realize that you have been concealing your authenticity as a trans female. It is literally a drop in the ocean compared to the revelation and the extraordinary change that comes with realizing that for all my life, I was a woman. And for all my life, I was suppressing that possibility because it could not be allowed. It was an unpalatable truth that I never shared with anybody. The most extraordinary thing that's ever happened to me. That plus meeting my partner Suzanne, who has a son from a previous relationship, and being able to help parent the madness and be in a loving relationship with a woman who showed me what unconditional love looks like has been, that's the gift. Yeah.
So we'll leave it there. It's kind of the perfect moment that sort of just flowed into the interview. Thank you so much for listening in today. I hope that you've learned something about yourself in this process. I know that I have. And I think you know now why I didn't do a big description of what Kristen's done because, you know, I don't think it's very believable. But to hear it from her own voice, what a beautiful journey it's been and how much she's grown along the way is just astounding. If you want to leave with one thing, maybe one question that you want to ask yourself, what in your life do you take for granted? Like we talked with Kristen about her memory, about how she has this photographic memory and she didn't realize other people had it. What about the way that you think have you taken for granted? Anyway, on that small note, I would just like to say thank you, have an awesome day, and tune in next week for more of This Australian Life. Let's find the feeling once again. Cause maybe you and I just can't be friends. Oh yeah, let's ride the freeway till the end. When loving is so good, you can't pretend. I know I left you hanging, but I'ma right my wrongs. I'ma write your love letters like I wrote this song. Gonna put a plan together, gonna put it all in motion. Every single thing I gotta do to fall back to you. You already know I had a lot on my mind. Oh yeah, but it's never too late to try.
But to the old town, has she Moving your direction, give me some affection, give me some.